You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Francesco Demetri is a prize-winning author of fiction and nonfiction, a comic book writer, and a screenwriter. He published 8 books in Italian before switching to English. His first Italian novel was made into a film. His first English novel, The Book of Hidden Things, was a critical and commercial success, and it's been optioned for cinema and TV. His second novel was Never the Wind, called by the Fortean Times one of the most wondrous writers of our time. His new novel is The Dark Side of the Sky. Thank you for joining me, Francesco.
Thank you, Rick. Thank you so much for having me.
The first thing I have to ask you is, you wrote 8 books in Italian and switched to English. When did you learn English? How did you learn English? And talk about that transition from conceiving of a book in one language. Did you conceive of the books written in English, in the English language?
It was a strange transition, because until I was 28, I basically spoke no English at all. I decided I wanted to be an English writer, because most of my favorite writers were English anyway. Or American, but they were writing in English. So I just decided to do it. And I didn't speak almost any English at all by then. I had some English I had learned from role-playing games, basically. So, you know, I could cast a Dungeons & Dragons spell in English, but I couldn't order breakfast. It was one of those things. And I decided to just do it. So I moved to London with my then girlfriend, who then became my wife. And I started making English friends, basically. I learned that the one thing you need to do in order to learn another language is make friends in the language they speak the language to you. So through my friends, very patient friends, they're still friends to this day, very patient friends were teaching me English just on the go, while we were at the pub or hanging out, you know, around London, that kind of stuff.
That is really an interesting story. Did you conceive of, I mean, in your brain, did you write The Dark Side of the Sky in English? Or did you?
Absolutely not.
Go ahead.
No, it is in English. When I'm writing in English, I think in English. You know, when I'm writing in Italian, I think in Italian, which is fine. It's a bit hard when I'm doing both at once, because sometimes I need to, you know, write something in English in the morning, something in Italian in the afternoon. That messes up my brain a little bit. As long as I only have one language per day, I'm fine.
Now, how is The Dark Sky to the Sky written? I've got to imagine there's an Italian version of it.
I'm not sure, if at some point a publisher will buy it for translation in Italian, there will be an Italian Dark Side of the Sky. But the whole story is very English to me. The way I was thinking about the story, the way I was thinking about presenting Puglia, my corner of Italy, was for an international audience. So I was thinking in terms of how can I make this thing, this corner of the world, which is so weird, so naturally weird, how can I make it interesting? How can I show its weirdness to the whole world? So that's the kind of question I was asking.
You know, that word weird is very important in the kind of fiction I read, because it's often described as weird fiction. And one of the authors you're compared to on the cover of this book is Robert Aichman. And I think that's a very apt comparison, because he was a very weird guy. He did not write straightforward supernatural fiction, and I think neither do you. So was he an influence on you?
Massive influence. I mean, I'm honored that someone would ever put me and Aichman in the same sentence. I'm not sure I deserve it, but I'll take it, because, hey, you always take good things in life, right? But yes, he was a massive influence on me. I always say I'm not a writer of the supernatural. I'm a realistic writer. I just tend to see the world in a strange way. Our world is deeply, deeply strange. the supernatural stories I find interesting are those that are giving me a different way of looking at the world. I'm not very interested in stories in which you have the world and then you have something that supernatural happen. And that's it. You know, I don't find that really intriguing. What I find intriguing is this thinking, what if the world in which we live were different? What if we got something wrong? You know, that's what I find upsetting and frankly fun.
You know, one of the things that strikes me is that I think we're seeing kind of, I just spoke to a fellow named Craig Foster, who was a fellow who directed a movie called My Octopus Teacher. And he talked about kind of rewilding humanity, throwing us back to the way we saw the world as primitive people, or as what we call primitive, but just in his mind, different. And this brought to mind the work of Carlos Castaneda. And I think there's a bit of that happening here as well. And it also fits into the other aspect of this book, which is, understanding whether people getting together are just getting together because they like one another and have something in common, or when does that cross over into being a cult?
I think these are two huge questions, huge themes. On the one hand, I think that we have lost something when we started believing that as humans, we are inherently separated by nature. Something the so-called primitive people have, something the hunter-gatherer societies still have, is this idea that they belong to nature, that we are an animal. Homo sapiens is an animal among other animals. So we have a chance to communicate with plants, animals, at some level, to some extent. You know, we have a chance to create a relationship there. And that relationship is what has been called magic in our society. Yeah? But it's just a name for a deeper relationship with nature, in a way. And then when is that a group becomes a cult? That's one of my favorite questions. I'm very passionate about cults. I did lots of research on cults before this book. I've been embedded as a journalist in cults, so I've seen them, you know, from the inside for a while.
Tell us about that experience. Which cult and how did you get yourself embedded? Was that part of the job or did you just volunteer?
It was part of the job. I've been studying many cults. The one that I studied for longer was called the Raelians. Recently, Netflix made a documentary about them. Actually, was there before Netflix with a bunch of friends. We were shooting a documentary in the early noughties. We were university students. And I was embedded with them for almost 2 years. I went to a secret camp with them, you know, somewhere in Eastern Europe, found myself with my friends and this bunch of UFO cultists isolated in the woods. They were interesting, very interesting, because they were normal. They are normal people. They're not psychos. They're not crazy. They're just like you and me, but they happen to have a fundamentally different set of beliefs. Many families can become like a cult. Relationships can become like a cult. I've seen many couples that act in a cultish way. So I think it's tricky because on the one hand, we need people. I'm very sociable. I like being with friends. You know, when I'm not reading, I'm with friends. I'm not a lone wolf. A lot of writers are like to be alone. I don't. I like being with people. I like being out. I like partying. I like groups of people. On the other hand, though, it's very easy to tip into cultish behavior. We think that cults are there and we are here, but actually there is a spectrum. And it's very easy for a group of friends to start acting in a slightly cultish way. It's very easy for a group of activists or political activists to start, you know, with the best possible intentions to start behaving a bit like a cult. And if you don't toe the line, you're not one of us anymore. You don't believe in our same set of values anymore. So maybe you should be expelled. But if you're expelled, you have lost something, etc., etc., etc. Human relationships are hard and difficult. Being a human among other humans is tricky, I think. And cultish behavior shows us that.
You know, it, it's interesting that when you were talking about humans being just essentially another animal, this is something, I don't know what nature documentary I saw, but I saw a documentary about termite mounds. And I was looking at these termite mounds and saying that if they were the size of buildings, I mean, we would not call them animals, and we might not want to call ourselves different from the animals, as the buildings we live in are just, you know, sophisticated termite mounds that we don't manage, you know, we don't make them by extruding them through our mouths, so we might be well advised to.
Absolutely. And if you look even at plant behavior, they communicate over long distances. You know, one of the reasons why I'm not a vegetarian, and I'm not kidding, I'm entirely serious about that. One of the reasons why I'm not a vegetarian is that I believe the plants have consciousness as well. Or they might have. I don't know if they do, but they might have. So I accept the violence that's inherent to life, but I do believe that there is a very real chance that most things in nature are conscious one way or another. I'm not saying they have exactly the same kind of consciousness we do as human beings, but it's just different. It's not less important. It's not lesser.
Now, this novel is told in an interesting style. It's a Rashomon style. We have lots of different short bits from different points of view, and you tell us the names of the characters. So first off, I'd like you to talk about, just, did you create the characters separately before the novel, or did you just start writing and let the characters come out of the writing?
I don't want to sound pretentious. I hate saying what I'm going to say, but I let characters do their thing. I'm not a planner. I can't plan a novel. I know fantastic writers who are great planners. So I'm not saying that by not planning, you end up with a better novel. I'm saying that when I tried planning, I ended up with crap novels. So it's only something that I can't do. I'm not saying that it can't be done. But as far as I'm concerned, the best way to find a novel is having an exploratory attitude. So I have a bunch of characters. I have an idea about those characters, you know, about who they are, a very rough idea about who they are, and then I let their actions reveal them, and I let the story reveal the characters as well. And then on a second and third draft, I try and pretend as if there was a plan all along, you know, but that's what the second and third draft are for. The first draft is about, hey, let's check it out. Let's see what's going on with these guys.
I love the characters and the different voices in this novel. And you do something very sneaky, too, with this revolving door of perception, and we'll get to that. Talk about, you know, you play with chronology in this novel, too, in that we get some of the backstory halfway through the novel. Talk about, you know, your sense of time. Did you did you understand the entire chronology of events in the novel before the novel, or did they arrive as you started it in media res, kind of like in the middle of the action?
They need to make sense for the reader. I think the novels are written for readers. Novels need to be interesting, fun. When you're reading my books, I want you to feel unable to put them down. And you don't get that necessarily creating event after event. You know, I like to have a slower rhythm sometimes, a slower pace of the narrative sometimes. But even then, even when the pace is lower, I want you to be fully immersed in the story. And in order to get there, I need to give you what I call points of interest. So if I need a slower pace in the present, it's quite useful to me to have something really interesting and strange and mysterious, or a revelation of some kind happening in the past. Because this is how you read in the novel. So when I'm slowing the pace in the present, I can speed it up in the past, and vice versa. But it's all about keeping readers engaged, because you have your phone with you when you're reading, you have your social media at hand, you have 1,000 distractions. I want you to forget about them and just, hey, listen to me, you know, look at me, like children do, but in a slightly less maniac way. So that's how I try. That's one of the reasons why I try to have different timelines, because I think it's more interesting for the reader. Within this particular book, of course, other books walk in a perfectly linear fashion.
You know, one of the things I love about this book was, you know, the way it's written, it's really, you walk this fine line between, it's pretty funny, but also it's pretty serious. The people are, you know, sometimes you're kind of making fun of them, sometimes they're making fun of themselves. Talk about that. I love that feel, and it's and ineffable, almost. It's very difficult to describe, but you just nail it page after page through the whole book.
First of all, thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. What can I say is, I think that life is too serious not to be funny. All the serious moments in life are slightly funny as well. Think about falling in love. You know, it is one of the most serious things that can happen to us. And yet we are awkward, we make mistakes, we say terrible things, we tell off-color jokes, you know, we bumble. Tell about death. There's nothing more serious than that. And yet we are so awkward and strange when we die. You know, we our bodies do things which are tragic, but they're also really funny when you look at them under a different perspective. I always believed that comedy is just tragedy told in a different voice. The only difference is voice between comedy and tragedy. You could take any Charlie Chaplin film and tell them as a straight tragedy. And you can take any tragic story, you know, love story, you know, the film, I mean, and tell it as comedy. It's just a matter of voice. And it's important to acknowledge the darkness in life. So I don't want to deny or diminish the darkness in life. But it's also important to understand that life is funny as well. And sometimes it's dark and funny exactly at the same time.
Now, the setup of this novel is that two people, Rick and Becca, have created a place. It's in a pine forest that's near the ocean in Italy. I confess I have some sabbatical with that. I live in Monterey Bay, and I live in the middle of pine forest, but I can walk to the Monterey Bay. So it's you know, I understand the beauty and the power of that kind of setting. And they've created a kind of a spiritual resort where... So talk about the way that you designed the setup. Was that, you know, always baked in, or did that kind of come as you wrote out the, you know, you tell the story from the people who point of view of people who are arriving?
Now, I put together two things I know well. It's a truism in writing, write to things you know, and I decided to put together two things I know well. One is Southern Italy, especially Puglia, this the hill of Italy, this corner of Southern Italy I come from, which is, as I was saying earlier on, a profoundly weird part of the country. We have mysterious people, we have strange folkloric traditions, we have a strange landscape, an interesting landscape. I mean, a stone throw away from my home, There are the ruins of a haunted masseria, where they say there is, among other things, an enchanting serpent which will stop you in place if they meet you. So, you know, it's that kind of land. It's a profoundly strange part of the country. People know it as a tourist place, because tourism is a pretty big industry now, but there is an inherent strangeness to that as well. And then I spent a lot, like Zoe, one of the characters in the book, I spent most of my adult life around spiritual types. So I've been to festivals like this, good and bad. I've seen most of the things that happen in the book. I've either seen them or heard about them. You know, I would say probably 85% of the things in the book come from real life. Of the most realistic part of the book as well, of course, they come from real life, from real experiences I had. So it is a world I know, and I decided to tell it words and all. It is a world I love, so I'm not making fun of the spiritual world, but it is a world that's full of deluded people. It's full of pranksters. It's full of hucksters. It's full of, you know, bonkers, self-deluded, self-aggrandizing idiots, so on and so forth. There's not only them, but there's a lot of them. So I just wanted to tell a world I know about a world I know.
I love the different characters and their backstories. Zoe especially, because she's the CEO of Soul Journey. A kind of like, you know, spiritual retreat company. And you know, the idea of a spiritual retreat company, it's inherently, you know, wrong from the get-go. So talk about people who, like, want to offer, you know, journeys that will, you know, experiences that will enhance your soul, which is something that seems like inherently wrong or unsellable.
I agree, but we live in a time and age in which, you know, salvation is for sale. Think about the trajectory of the Glastonbury Festival or of the Burning Man, for that matter. They start as free festivals and end up as large corporate events. Burning Man is probably my favorite example, you know, but Glastonbury Festival is exactly the same. You start with this authentic countercultural vibe, this authentic desire of creating something which goes against the grain, for better or worse, you know, but which goes against the grain of society. And then you end up having a bank account, creating a society, creating an organization, having risk assessments, so on and so forth. And you end up being exactly what you were fighting against. I don't think that's unavoidable. I think that you can keep fighting for your entire life, but you need to be damn careful if you want to do that, because it's very easy to tip into something else. Zoe is a character I really love because she's not pleasant. She's not a pleasant person at all, but she's sincere. She grew cynical because of the things she has seen and done, but she's sincere. She really wants something that she can't quite define, as much many of us do. But she ended up having an organization, a bank account, and being a CEO. And that's how lots of spiritual types end. And that's, you know, if you look on Instagram, you will find plenty of really expensive festivals that promise you they will change your life in exchange for a fee. Yeah. I'm not sure how that works, but hey, that's their business model.
You know, one of the things that's interesting in this book is there's a lot of sex at this festival, and it's pretty constant. And I think you do a really good job of making us understand that the characters are invested in and interested in the sex. You back off the details so that, you know, it's not like you're describing things that we wish you hadn't. I like to just talk about, you know, the approach to sex in this book. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, this might be an R-rated movie, maybe, but it wouldn't have to be. And I think that's like, you know, it's really brilliantly done, even though it's kind of like, a lot of this book, I think, is an excellent example of serious brilliance done in a manner that, you know, you don't really necessarily notice.
Thank you. It's a beautiful description of what I try to do, you know, creating something meaty which goes under the radar, which is, you know, fun and easy to read. I like sex very much. Unapologetically so. I've been in an open relationship for most of my adult life. I've done a lot of the things that happen in the book, again, even from sexual point part, in the sexual part of the book, you know, I've been there, been around. I think that we are too shy around sex. We are still too shy around sex. Sex is still seen as something that should be, you know, necessarily related to romanticism, as in having a relationship with another person, or it's something that can be a waste of time, or it's something that's inherently aggressive. We have a lot of wrong ideas about sex. I like the idea of sex with friends. I like the idea that, you know, sex is just another way of being with people. You have conversations, you have meals, and with some people, at the right time, at the right moment, with the right people, you can have sex. And this is how they leave sex in my book. But also, sex is really dangerous, because sex can indeed become a form of control. And in many cults, control passes through sex, through the control of sex. All religions we know have rules about sex. They're telling you that you should do this, you shouldn't do that, you should do that on specific days for specific reasons, etc., etc., etc. The point of those rules is the rule per se, is that they're controlling your body through controlling sex. The rule, the content of the rule is comparatively unimportant. What matters is that there is a rule for you. And they say, fuck that. You know, we don't need any rule. As long as we are consenting adults, we really, really, really don't need any rule. So really, we can really, really go wild. It's our body. We probably have just one chance to enjoy it. So let's make the most of it while we can.
Now, the characters in this book meet in a place that, you know, the inner circle, the Pinewood, and the way they achieve, you know, a higher state of consciousness is through humming together, which is both just a little bit funny, but also you can say, yeah, that kind of makes sense, that would work. Talk about, you know, approaching how your characters will achieve an altered state of consciousness in a manner that the readers will accept it, but also, you know, say, you know, leave room for her that sliver of doubt.
Well, it's, again, it's realistic, because the idea that by humming together and breathing together, we are alterating our consciousness and reaching a state in which we connect to each other is actually scientifically proven. There is a reason why all religions, or most religions, have hymns. You go to church, you start singing. From a very young age, they start indoctrinate you through singing. They make you sing with other people, with your friends, etc., etc., etc. That's because you are breathing in and out together. You are tuning in to the others. And that works as a technology for alterating your consciousness. It does work. So the reason why it sounds so realistic is that it is. It's actually used. It's used ritually all over the world. It's used in shamanistic rituals, in Christian rituals. It's used in Jewish rituals, in Wiccan rituals. Name it, in Islamic rituals for sure. Name it. You would see some version of that, of this breathing in and out together. And I find that really interesting, because it has to do, whatever we think about the ultimate reality of the revelations you receive, you know, it might be entirely bollocks, it might be, you know, something you're making up with your mind, you know, altered state of consciousness, or it might be something real. I don't know, it's not my place to say. What I can say is that things happen. We know that things happen when you act that way. And things happen because as humans, we are already connected to other humans. We are a social animal. We need to be with other people. We crave the presence of other people. We crave this being together with other people. And that makes us really powerful, but also really vulnerable. Because when we end up in the hands of the wrong kind of people, then it's easy for them to transform our desire of belonging into something really dark and not really good.
You know, one of the things I always liked about Robert Aikman's books and stories was his sense that the oddball psychology of humans was itself a sort of supernatural form of the supernatural. And all of us, nobody's particularly normal in his stories, or even if they are normal in their circumstances, seems really weird. And I think you absolutely nail that kind of duality between the psychology of your characters and the strangeness that they're able to achieve through the combinations of their psychologies or their characters. That makes us one of the reasons this book is such a page turner is because even if the action on the ground is not that much, I mean, they're not out there fighting vampires and monsters or any of that kind of stuff. But what they are is the characterizations are turning on these kind of fine points, and the interactions and the friction of those interactions is where reality begins to break.
Yes. Well, reality is a construct anyway. There's a fantastic book that's called The Social Construction of Reality. It was written by two sociologists. To an extent, reality is a construct. Think about money. Well, money is so important for our lives, but money doesn't exist. It's not even physical anymore. It's just, you know, numbers on a screen that somebody made up. And yet, it's not only important for us from a practical perspective, but many of us base their identity on how much money they have or on their lack of money. It becomes part of your identity. This amazingly stupid idea that somebody had of creating money becomes part of who you are. A lot of reality is made up. There are things which are ultimately real, I think. I think, you know, if you bang your head against a wall, probably you are going to break your head in the end. But most things we deal with, they're not really, really real. They're construct. Our notion of love is socially constructed. And I'm a romantic. I believe in love. But I'm also perfectly aware that if I were living in Papua Nova Guinea in the 16th century, my idea of love would be fundamentally different. And there has been, again, lots of scientific research about this, about how even emotions are culturally placed. And we need to break reality, because otherwise we end up believing that we are the only weirdos. We know we are weird. You know, I'm sure that you know you're a weirdo. I know I'm a weirdo. But we believe, it's easy to end up believing that everybody else is just normal. Well, we are 7 billion weirdos on this planet. Everybody's strange. We are just pretending to be normal. And, you know, pretending is fine in order to be together as long as we realize we are pretending. But if we end up believing the bollocks we say about our normality, then it's dangerous. Then it becomes dangerous. And we end up leading a very gray, uninteresting, and uncurious life. So in order to make our life, I think, more interesting, we need to bring reality to its breaking point, to the point when we can say we are weird, people around us are weird as well, and that's fine.
Yeah. Wow, well, that should be the beginning of a new constitution of some country. 7 billion
weirdos. I don't want to end up creating a real cult.
Yeah. You know, as we go through the various characters in this book, you know, there are all each one is carefully titled, and we find this character, Bastian. Now, of course, on one hand, it will, for some of us who are well alive in the 80s, it'll bring back the name of a character from the never-ending story. And he was the main character who kind of held reality together. And it was a story of the power of reading. And so as I was reading these portions by Bastian, which are always written in the first person plural, it's a fascinating device. Talk about, you know, there are not a lot of novels that include a character who speaks in the first person plural.
Well, originally, the plan for the book, the entire novel was written in the first person plural. And the first person plural would journey among the different characters, so to speak. But it was far too complicated, and it was a little boring. The result was a little boring, to be honest. So I decided to have the first person plural as just one of the characters. But I needed it because a group is different than the sum of its members. When we are in our family, when we are in a relationship, when we are with our friends, we have our mind, the other people in the group have theirs, but then there is a third mind, which is the group mind, which is very different. I mean, people in a group can do horrible things that they would never do on their own, people in a group, you bring a few good people in a group, you condition them enough and they will kill. And none of them would have killed on their own. They wake up the next morning and say, what the hell did we do? You know, a lot of witch hunts work this way. You would have people getting worked up in a group against somebody in the village or in the neighboring village, and they would kill them and they would do horrible things to them. But none of those people, none of those persons taken singularly would have done the same. But there is a group mind for good as well. Groups can, you know, be generous, can save lives when, again, no single individual would have the courage to step in. So there is always a mind, which is the group mind. And everybody who's ever been in a relationship can understand what I mean. I think there is your mind, there is your partner or your partner's mind, and then there is a mind of the couple, trouble, of the people in the relationship, which is a different mind yet. And they wanted to have a narrator that was the mind of the group that all people belonged to.
It's such a fascinating idea, and it really makes for an interesting part in this kind of Rashomon deal where we see things from different points of view. Talk about, you know, describing the same event from different points of view, and there are some really strikingly terrifying parts in this book. And I don't want to give them away, even if they, you know, come early. They do come early, and they come often enough. Talk about, you know, that parallax view where we see this and we see it from here. And, you know, you might do something in the group and look back and go, oh, my God, why did I do? Oh, my God, was that me?
Yes. Yeah, I think that we've all been there. And I think this is scary enough. And I think that it's also quite scary when we realize how plural reality is. When we realize that there are, if you have two people that look at the same thing, they won't even see physically the same thing. There was an experiment they did at some point in which they asked two people if a car had run over a pedestrian. And one of the people present said it wasn't a car, it was a bicycle. So they couldn't even remember what kind of, you know, what kind of thing was happening. They wouldn't even remember if it was a car or a bike, which seems a pretty easy thing to remember, right? But that's how our minds work. That's how we work as human beings. And if you think about that, this should lead us to be very prudent when we say that we are the good guys and other people are the bad guys, that some people are behaving terribly while we try to be moral. They aren't. You know, the polarity that we live in is really suffocating. It's really scary to me. I'm not saying that there is nothing good and nothing bad. I'm not a relativist. I think that some things are better than others. But I'm not sure I'm the one doing that. I'm the one doing the good things. You know what I mean? We can never be sure of that, because there's always other ways of looking at a problem or looking at something. And if you think about all the major tragedies in history, they were always created by the good guys. They were always created by people trying to do good, to do their own version of good, whatever it was. Again, I'm not saying that we shouldn't act. I'm just saying we should be very prudent, very careful in making statements about how good we are and how terrible the others are.
This book also turns on a really fascinating idea. And I actually encountered this idea in a very different form long ago in reading a collection by the Polish science fiction writer Stanisław Lem. He had a collection called A Perfect Vacuum, which was perfect reviews of non-existent books. And one of the books he reviewed was called Pericalypsis. And the premise of this book was that the apocalypse had already come and gone and went unnoticed in the general haste. And that's why he called it the Pericalypse, the cataclysm that was very close to because, and your novel turns on this, on a basically a very similar idea. So talk about the idea of cataclysms that have happened, but that we don't know about.
The world is over. I mean, I was born in 1981. I was a teenager in the 90s, and we were told that basically we would always be okay. You know, that as Western kids, as middle class Western kids, we would be okay, that we had nothing to fear. And then 9/11 happened, and then 2008 happened, and our lives get upended. And then we realize that climate breakdown is happening. There's no way of stopping it. We can slow it down, but you know, it's already happening. In our corner of the world, in Puglia, Xylella fastidiosa, a bacterium, has destroyed most olive trees. And it was a part of our landscape, an important part of our landscape. And now you move in these, you know, kilometers and kilometers and kilometers of dead trees. And these trees were centuries years old. So large, thick, marvelous giants, dead. So we live in an apocalyptic world. It's all right. There have been other apocalypses in the past, and the planet survived, the universe survived, and probably humankind survived as well. We'll see if we survive this one. So we are going through an apocalypse. The world is over. The world as we knew it is over. With COVID, with the world that are happening, whatever new world comes out of it, it won't look like anything that we knew and took for granted. I mean, it wasn't extraordinarily good for most of people on this planet. So maybe something better will come out. I'm not saying that we are fucked. Climate breakdown is a disaster, but the planet will survive and we'll find probably ways to cope with it and maybe to do some good to our planet as well. But we need to acknowledge that the order as we knew it is over. We need to acknowledge that a certain way of living is gone forever.
Now, I don't think I'm giving away any spoilers in saying that there are definitely some weird things afoot in this novel. And I'd like you to talk about, you know, slicing in the truly weird bits with, you know, otherwise what seems like a slice of life. You know, it's like you find the one moldy piece of bread with ergot on it, and all of a sudden you're, you know, oh wow, this world is a little bit different than I expected.
Yeah, when the supernatural appears in the book, it does appear. You know, it's pretty strong. Strange enough, it doesn't look like that because you see it from the perspective of the characters, but you know, it's pretty strong what's going on. I think the kind of supernatural I'm interested in books need to have two features. One, it needs to be realistic somehow. You need to feel that it could happen. Maybe not exactly in your world, but in an adjacent world, yes. So you need to believe in it as long as you read the book. And the second thing that it needs to be beautiful. It needs to be visually interesting. I have no patience for the supernatural that's not visually interesting, because with words, you are painting on page. It's a great chance you have. So I want to create images, ideas that will stay with you somehow, that you will see in your mind's eye. Say, all right, that's cool. I can't see it physically because, you know, it doesn't exist. It's not the way our world works, but I can see it with my mind's eye. And after that, my personal reality is slightly larger. You know, I have something that I didn't have before. I have a new image in my mind, something beautiful, interesting, arresting, horrible maybe, but interestingly horrible, that stays with me after a while. So I'm interested in that. It's what one of my favorite writers of all time is Clive Barker. Clive Barker, at his peak, he was a master in creating scenes, supernatural scenes that you would just see, that you would just stare at on page.
I can't agree more. Certainly one of my favorite and some of my favorite reading experiences. Talk about, you know, as you wrote this book, you know, and as I read it, I'm thinking, that, you know, this is a book where, you know, at first, as you think, well, this is a book all about, you know, people, and they're isolated, and the characters deliberately are asked to take away their phones and their iPads and essentially eschew all contact with reality. And this reminded me of the decision made by some mystery writers these days to say, I'm going to set my book in the 1980s because there were no cell phones. I don't have to deal with that in the plot. And so early on, you get rid of all the social media. Yet, it doesn't stay that way. And I think that is, you know, when it comes to horror, it's not the monsters, it's the media.
I mean, there's nothing more terrifying than a Twitter mob. You can stir a Twitter mob with a few fake words, you know, with you can bend what somebody says very easily. And if you're lucky, you will have your mob at your hands. So we have real monsters on digital media. We don't only have real monsters again, but we're talking of the horror here. So yes, we have real monsters on digital media. What you say about, you know, setting your novel when you don't have to bother with phones? You know, in a lot of clumsily written horror, you see that. You see cells that don't, that there's no signal here. Oh, damn it! So we're isolated. So you see this kind of cheap narrative devices. For me, I tried not to do that. I wanted to create a real sense of bliss on the one hand, because it is real bliss, you know, to go somewhere beautiful, surrounded by friends, making music and love for a few days, having great food, great wine, great drugs, and not having to bother with your phones. You know, it's for a few days. I think that can be real bliss. But there's also the other side of it, that we need that in order to be connected with the world, whether we like it or not. I'm not a huge fan of social media, but whether we like them or not, they are part of our experience. They are part of the way in which we live to them, the way in which we connect to other people. So it's very easy to weaponize both social media and the lack of social media. Again, there are no certainties there. I like, in my writing, I like to have readers wondering. I have no answers for them, but I like them to ask questions with me. I like to ask them questions and see what they come up with.
The effect is that it makes the more surrealistic seem equally realistic, because our technology itself today is surreal and enables the surreal. I mean, to somebody even 150 years ago, the idea of an iPad or an iPhone, it wouldn't be magical. It'd be fairly terrifying. It could, because you could just show them things on there and they go, oh my God, this is a portal to hell. And we're discovering that. In fact, yes, our iPhones and iPads are portals to hell.
You know, heaven and hell are quite close, I think. And that's one of the tragedies of life. This thing we're doing is only made possible by very advanced digital technologies. And this thing we're doing is great. We're having a chat, which I'm finding very interesting. You are forcing me to think, which is something I really love. And we are doing a bit of promotion for my book, which is great for my mortgage. You know, we're doing great things, and we are doing that because of digital media. But also, it's very easy to end up doom scrolling, spend your entire day obsessing because some other writer has more readers than you. You know, their book is doing better than yours, or silly things like that. So it's a matter of using technologies rather than being used by them, which seems a truism. But the problem with social media is that as a technology, they are inherently steering us in a specific direction. They're not a neutral technology. No technology is neutral, but social media even less than most. So I have nothing against digital media in particular, but social media can be really dangerous. Again, there can be a wonderful, you know, connection, finding people. It's not all bad, but there is a real danger that because of the way they work, they've been created by a capitalist society to hook us up for a specific mean, which is hooking us up to the machine and selling us advertisement at the end of the day. So we just need to be careful. That's what I'm saying.
You know, as I read this book, I'm thinking, boy, one of the things that makes it so compelling is the closer you get to the end, the less you know how it's going to end. And so I'm wondering, did you know? I could imagine that you could written like 3 or 4 different versions of this book based on how you decided to end it. Did you, or did you just follow it through to where it goes at present? Did you know in advance of how it would work?
Almost never. This is the first time. This is the 13th book I publish. I did a comic book series as well. I did a film. So I've been doing lots of stories. This is the first time I knew how the book would end from the moment I started. I began it. I had a very clear idea, and that's how the book ended. That's how, yeah, that's where it went.
That's really interesting. You know, as a writer of weird fiction, one of the things that, you know, and as a reader myself of weird fiction, I really like, you know, I like a weird payoff. And I think that's one of the things you do in this book. You take us through realistic situations that are compelling reading, and you give us a number of weird payoffs. How do you pace the insertion of the supernatural into your work?
It needs to be aesthetically pleasant, as pretentious as it may sound again, but it needs to be, supernatural needs to come at a moment in which it's aesthetically nice, is something, and it also needs to be, to feel as a natural development of what's happening on all other levels of the book. So this is my way of doing supernatural fiction. I'm not saying it's the only way. One of my favorite films in history is From Dusk Till Dawn, when you have, you know, no supernatural for half the film, and then suddenly they're all vampires. So, and that works very well, and that works fantastically well. So I'm not saying it's the only way it works, but the way I like writing the supernatural is as a development of everything else that's going on. So I get you there. I want you to get to the supernatural almost without noticing. So you're writing, you're saying, yes, 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 yeah, but hang on a minute, what did I just read? Like, this is not, you know, this is not how the world works. What's going on? And maybe you try to find your way back and understand when things started getting strange. So that's the way I like writing it. But again, it's just my choice. I'm not saying it's the only way of writing it or it's the only way I like it. It's just the way I like writing it.
It's the way I like reading it. I've been speaking with Francesco Dimitri. His new novel is The Dark Side of the Sky. Thank you for joining me, Dimitri. Or Francesco.
Thank you so much, Nick. Thank you so much, Nick. It was a real pleasure.
Thank you so much, Francesco.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.